anyone seen our co-chair? Is he out there, Sue? The co-chair. You can answer to any. Well, good afternoon and welcome. We're going to get started here. Just procedurally, so everybody in the room is aware of what I'm going to do and what the committee is going to do today. We scheduled a couple of hours to talk about Fireman Fun Day. We hope that's enough time. I know there are a lot of you that probably have traveled a long ways, and consistent with the way I believe, and thank goodness in Wyoming where we have access to our elected officials, if you've got something to say, we're going to try to afford you that opportunity to have public testimony. Procedurally, what we're going to do is we're going to allow Ruth and Steve to come up, and we're going to talk about some options he presented to us. A lot of it you heard before, but I want to go over it one more time so everyone on the committee is very clear about the options we've discussed, any questions on that, anything we might be doing in that vein. Then what we're going to do procedurally is Dave's here. Dave Grew is going to walk us through the bill, explain the bill to us, what the bill does, doesn't do. We're going to have questions as a committee, and then at that point in time, I'm going to open it up for any comments from the public, pro or con. And one thing I will not tolerate in this committee or any committee that I have anything to do with is people that are not civil or don't stick to the facts. And we're here to try to do what's right. There's a lot of issues here. Sometimes these get to be sensitive, but I hope that you'll respect our rights, and we will certainly respect yours, so we will keep it civil. If somebody gets out of line, I'll be the first to tell them that. If they continue to get out of line, it would be the same for a member of the legislature, then we will make appropriate action. So we're welcome, and we look forward to your testimony. Procedurally, this is the first step of many steps. I want you all to understand that. If, in fact, we do have a bill today, not sure we will, but if we do, that just starts the process. That bill will be referred to the budget session that starts in February. Since it's a budget session, it will require two-thirds vote to even be introduced. Once it gets introduced, it will be assigned to committee either in the House or the Senate. One of the appropriations committee, these seven people over here, the five of us, will have it in committee. And then again, all of you will have an opportunity to come to that committee meeting and present your testimony and public opinions, whether you like the bill, you don't like the bill, where we are, what we think. And then we will do that in that respective body. Vote on it up or down, then we go to the other body and do it all over again. So I want you to be sure and understand that we have a very thorough process of allowing you, the public, to express to us your concerns as we try to develop legislation that fits the needs of all of us. And sometimes that's difficult. That's what we're going to try to do here today. Mr. Co-Chair, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think, Mr. Co-Chair, just a couple things. I remember 8 years ago, I think I sat over there when this issue first came, and Governor Friedenthal recommended we don't have to touch this for 20 years. And so all of us have that probably curse of time. I thought, gosh, 20 years. Jeez, that'll never come. Well, 8 years later, now we're looking at probably a 10-year window on this before it flat goes broke. And so we want to take some action. We want to do the right thing. And we'll take a lot of input on this, and hopefully together in the committee process we'll come up with something that'll actually work and folks can go home and maybe not get everything you wanted, but we find a solution that folks, everybody can live with. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and I would echo that. You know, we're here to work with you, listen to you. We have a lot of demands of the Appropriations Committee through our state. There's only so much money that can go around, and we listen to all of the budgets, all of the people, all the concerns. We try to balance that. So that's the process, and that's what we're going to do. Members of the committee, any of you have any comments you'd like to bring to the table at this point in time? Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to recuse myself from this process. I am one of Plan A members.
Certainly that's your prerogative, Representative Moniz. I would ask you to stay and participate and listen and all that you're asking specifically for the vote or not to participate in the process.
The vote.
Thank you. Good. We appreciate you sticking around. We can ask you questions. Anybody else on the committee have anything you'd like to say? Okay, Ruth, Steve, come on up. We'll start going through the, I believe there are seven options. Is that correct, that we went through before? Yep, let's just kind of go through them. The committee, you all have those options in front of you. Pat, do all your people have those options if they've been afforded that opportunity? Do we have any, have they seen them? Have they been provided copies? Do we have extra copies of those that sheet? Would it help if we got 8 or 10 copies in case some of your people wanted to see them, Pat? Okay, let's do that. Let's get some made, please. Okay, Ruth, the floor is yours.
By way of background, just so when we talk about 7 options, we have 1 new option in the report that we gave you with today's budget hearing. That option we were asked to provide, basically we started out in November being told, how do we split the costs 3 ways, a third, a third, a third? That's in this memo. That came down to a 2.1% compound COLA. That's one of the 6 options in the November memo. The most recent one you have is we were asked to look at a 2.1% simple COLA, so that would not be compounded. And what that does is reduce the current unfunded liability down to approximately $43,669,000. And that is from the original projections. The original projections had an unfunded liability of $68,054. So that brings the unfunded liability down about $25 million, so more than a third.
Yeah, one thing, too, to be clear is, as I recall the testimony we received from you, that if, in order to get the actuarial soundness that we're all concerned about, if the COLA went away, we would need $14 million to get to that 100% number. If the COLA remained at 3% compounded, we would have to have a cash infusion of $69 million. Is that correct?
$68 million, Mr. Chairman.
$68 million. Okay. Everybody got that? Okay. Please proceed.
So would you like me to go over each study
yes.
in the original?
Okay. Yep, I do.
One of the things you'll notice when you look at all these projections is normally with the big plan, we amortize over 30 years. When you have an open plan, you've got new people coming in. It's effectively a perpetual plan. As people retire, you've got new people coming in. So 30-year funding works for that. With a plan like Fire A, you normally shorten the time period when it's closed and you have almost all retirees. You want that plan fully funded in 10 years. That's why it looks more expensive than it would otherwise if we still had a 30-year time period. So on the November 14th memo, the first study we looked at was basically just the existing plan. And that plan showed a $68 million unfunded liability, and that would cover both the base benefit and the COLA. So we use that for comparison purposes. At this point, the plan is approximately 67% funded. When you compare that, and on the bottom of the sheet, if the state picked up a third, or basically half of the remaining liability, and the cities paid the other half, that's the split at the bottom. It's about $5 million a year for the cities to split.
Are you on study one?
Study one, yes, sir.
And you're on looking at Appendix A that says Study One. Is that where you are?
Yes.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, this is to be used for reference purposes. This is the plan as it is right now, with the 3% compounded COLA and the benefits as they are.
On that chart where you have the annual benefit payments, the $14.5 million, that's the amount that's paid out to retirees, correct? Is that what that is?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you. Okay.
And we used this amount that's being paid out to retirees to ratio the amount of contributions from the employers, basically saying what we're paying out is your share of the total, and that's how we'd split the liability. Study two, the actuary looked at saying if everybody takes an equal hit, a third, a third, a third, so the retirees are taking a hit, the cities are going to pay a third, and the state pays a third. The actuary calculated that by reducing the COLA to a 2.1% compound, that would mean the retirees would be picking up a third of that liability. That leaves $49 million to be split between the employer and the state.
That's a 10-year amortization, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Part of that. And on sheet study two, where do you get the $49 million?
the very first row, column 13, it says unfunded accrued actuarial liability.
Column 13 or?
It's column 13, yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, what that figure is... Mr. Chairman?
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
What that figure represents is if you would pump $49 million into the system on day one, that's all you would have to spend. But if you amortize it over a 10-year period, you're going to pay considerably more than that. And what you'd have to pay is the combination of the very last or total row in column 8 and 9 on that same chart.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hastert?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ruth, just to make sure that I completely understand this, when we're speaking of employer, we are speaking of the cities, and are we speaking every city in the state?
Mr. Chairman, it's the cities that are listed at the bottom of the page. So...
Yeah, there's several different things that have been handed out. One, it's on Appendix A, Study 2. Is that the one you're looking at, Senator Hastert? Mm-hmm. And if you go down, it says optional original fire area employee allocation. That's where it shows how much the cities would pay per year. And this. I'm on an old report. I got that one too.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Reverend Nicholas.
Just so I understand that, under the 2% compound COLA, if the cities are required to cover half of the cost of the remaining balance between the state and the city, that they would have to pay, based upon over a 10-year period, $36 million per year. Is that correct?
3.6.
I mean 3.6. Is that right?
Yeah, 3.6 million, Representative Nicholas. That's the number I have. I hope everybody's on the same page. I am. Committee, you all got the same information? John, you got it? We're all set? Okay. We are on Study 2. Continue.
All right. Basically, Mr. Chairman, that's all I had on Study 2, unless there are questions.
Any questions? Any questions? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Study 3 on the next page has the 2.1% compound COLA, but on this one, the actuary had a pay-as-you-go basis so that the employer would be paying the COLA that was paid each year to those retirees. It sounds less expensive to begin with, but if you look at the bottom of the page, that employer amount increases every single year because the COLA is compounding on itself. If you don't pre-fund it and you don't earn money on that money, you basically, the employers will be paying an increasing COLA amount for a long time until the last retiree is gone. So we are, while the actuary did this, we would not recommend that this would be a reasonable funding method.
Yeah, just so we're clear on that one, and it starts out that the cities, towns, and count, or the cities, those specific towns, cities would pay $309,000 and $213,000. I'm sorry, $1,135,000, and then the combination of those two. That's correct, isn't it? You'd add them two together?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And if you look at the top, that top line under column 13, you notice the unfunded accrued actuarial liability goes down to $14 million. That's just the base benefit. So if the state was to put $14 million in day one, the base benefit would be totally funded, and all we'd be looking at is that ad hoc, is that COLA, that 3%. In this case, 2.1% COLA.
So the state or the employers could pay that entirely at that point in time, and then all you have to deal with is the COLA.
That's correct, sir.
And that would be at the 2.1% compounded, correct?
That's correct.
Everybody got that? Okay. That's Study 3, right?
Correct. Mr. Chairman, this is the continuation of Study 3. What it's showing is the effect of that COLA amount and how it increases every single year. This is split by employers. So if you look at the first row, the city of Casper, whose current benefit payments are about $4.3 million for existing retirees, they start paying $91,000 a year in COLA benefits only. That goes up to $185,000 the second year, $281,000 the third. So as you see, that every time there's an increase, that increases the amount the employer has to be paying out. So by 2022, Casper's not paying out $91,000. They're paying out just over $1 million. That's why we would not recommend pay-as-you-go, because if the money's in earning money, it's a much more effective way to fund a benefit.
Senator Meyer.
Ruth, I'm going to ask a question. I don't think we have the answer to it, but maybe we can get to it at a later time. The question is, on retirement benefits, how does that figure into, say, Medicare offsets or payments if a person goes to a nursing facility? What I'm getting at, and you're giving me a strange look on that one there, but I'm just looking at it from the standpoint of what the retiree would get back in net benefits, with the assumption that they're in a nursing facility in about 10 years, and essentially all the retirement benefits would be going to the nursing facility and Medicare would be picking up nothing.
Well, then that gets into a bigger issue, whether or not Medicare is even a part of it.
And that's the question, Mr. Chairman.
And we have that, and we've got some information to talk about Medicare. Senator Perkins, you got a comment?
I don't think Medicare doesn't cover nursing home care.
Well, so, I understand that, but Medicare component. Wait a minute, let's settle down a second. Go ahead, Senator Perkins.
I was just saying, Medicare doesn't. I mean, to be qualified for nursing, Medicare only pays for maybe up to 100 days of nursing home care, or it can be longer if there's actual rehabilitation going on. But once you not have a rehabilitation, that ends, and it's either going to be self-pay, it's going to be paid through long-term insurance, or it's going to be paid on the Medicaid program. If you're on Medicaid program, you have a number of available assets. Yeah, there's three tests. You've got a medical necessity test to be in the nursing home. You've got a available resource test, which it depends whether you're married or single. If you're single, it's basically $2,000 of non-exempt assets. And the income test, and the income is, as you said, that income has to be, except for about $50 a month, has to be contributed towards the care of the nursing home attendee. There's some exceptions, again, if you're married. But so I don't know that it has
Yeah, the Medicaid portion of that for nursing homes, everybody would be treated similarly. The Medicare is a different issue in Social Security. And maybe this is a good time for, you sent me some information on that, Ruth, and I've got that email here. Could you explain that to us, please, what you think happens with Medicare?
Or Medicaid.
I think we've answered Medicaid. Medicare, please.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, if I remember the email correctly, you ask about coverage, Medicare coverage for the FIRA individuals.
Yep.
New hires after, it was either 86 or 87, were mandated to pay into Social Security or to Medicare. All of the FIRE A individuals were hired prior to that date. So unless they have another job or coverage through a spouse, they do not have Medicare coverage. They have not had to pay in. So that's an issue where unless they got it elsewhere, they did not get it through their FIRE job.
And then the Social Security, they had a Section 218 agreement as well?
Mr. Chairman, they are exempt from Social Security, so they don't have the Social Security benefit, nor do they have the Medicare benefit.
Pat, do you concur with that pretty much? Get a mic, Pat, would you please?
Pat Crane.
Just get a mic here.
Pat Crank, representing Fireman's A. It's our understanding that to qualify for Medicare, you have to have a certain number of employed quarters, and that a large number of our members probably don't have those number of quarters of employment in a job other than as a fireman that would qualify them to be able to receive Medicare benefits.
So essentially, since it was all pre-1986, unless they came and got another job after that, there is no Medicare, is what we're saying.
Correct.
We all agree on that? Okay, thank you. Kurt, did you have anything else?
No.
Okay. Drew, you got anything else? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at that scenario three. I don't know a lot about these smaller fire districts like the Natrona County Fire Protection District. I guess the question I would have is, if you look at their payments, I'm not real sure on what their budgets look like, and what I am concerned about is what effect that amount of money is going to have on a small fire protection district. This could be their whole current public safety budget now, so what would they do with their public safety budget going forward? And that's a real big concern I have.
I'm not sure you can answer that specific district, but anybody here be able to answer that? Okay. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next study we have is study four, and that was a 3% simple COLA instead of compounded. What this does is it does the COLA on a pay-as-you-go as well. So as you can see, that unfunded accrued actuarial liability goes down to just over $14 million right away. That's just the base benefit. But as you can see, the numbers increase every single year that the employer has to pay out by not pre-funding. And the page after that shows it by employer, and it shows that increasing. So City of Casper starts out at $131,000. By 2022, they've got $1.3 million, and this is just the COLA piece they're paying out. So even though the actuaries ran this, we would not recommend a pay-as-you-go basis. It would be very, very difficult for the employer to cover it in that respect.
Okay, questions on that study? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, on the next study is study five. What that does is it reduces the compound COLA from 3% to 1.5%, and that's still a compound COLA. That reduces the actuarial unfunded liability to $37 million. So we've gone from 68 to $37 million. So you've dropped it by over $30 million. And then if you split the difference between the employer and the state, which is what we did here, on an annual basis, the split with the employers would be paying $2.797 million, and you can see the split there. And this is assuming half from the state, half from the employers. If a lump sum of $37.9 million was paid in, it would be fully funded.
So this is you reduce the 3% to 1.5%, you compound it, and what's left is split between the employer, being the cities, and the state. And it's an amortization over 10 years. Okay? Everybody got that? Okay, that's study five. Study six.
Mr. Chairman, what study six does is it takes that 1.5%, it goes from 3% compound to 1.5% simple. So that 1.5% COLA would not compound on itself over the years. That drops the unfunded liability to $35 million. So if $35 million was put in the fund today, it would be fully funded. If the cost is split between the employer and the state and it's amortized over a 10-year period, it's approximately on the first year $2.6 million for the employers to pick up.
Okay. Questions? And then we have study seven, which is a 2.5% simple rather than compounded, correct? Everybody have that one? It's on our SharePoint, and it's in today's handout, both. Make sure we're all looking at the same one. Everybody got it, committee?
Page 7.
Everybody got it? It's either here or on your SharePoint. Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like me to explain that one, we went from the 2.1% compound COLA that we initially calculated down to 2.1% simple, and that's study 7. That drops the unfunded liability from $68 million down to $43 million. So effectively $26 million is being picked up through the COLA reduction. And with the first year, if it's split 50-50 between the employers and the state, it's about $3.2 million for the employers.
And as I look at the study one that's compounded, study two, which is the 2.1% compounded, and study seven, which is the 2.1 simple, the employer contribution is $3.6 million for the compounded versus $3.2 million for the simple. Correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
And then the unfunded liability is $49 million versus $43 million. Correct? Everybody got that? Okay. Question I have, Ruth, tell me about the to the retirees, and I don't know if you can do this like 10 years out. I think we're starting at the level they're at now is $45,000 a year, give or take some change. Is that average where they are roughly? What's the difference if they have a 2.1% compounded where they'll be in 10 years versus 2.1% simple? Do you have any idea what that number is?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to go back and calculate it, but we did not do
hey,
that.
Why don't you put that on your list since this is long from being over? It'd be interesting to see what that number is from the retiree's perspective, what the effect on them would be in that regard. We can see what it is to the city and the cities and the state. Okay, committee, you've seen all the studies. Any specific questions anyone has before we have Dave walk us through the bill? Any questions? Okay. Dave's out there somewhere. There he is. Is that on the bill on SharePoint, or do we have? We got it right here, don't we? Okay. Dave, would you walk us through the bill, please? Thanks, Ruth. And Steve, stick around. We may have a question for you.
Mr. Chairman, you should have LSO 71W5.
That's it.
Okay. Starting on page one, we'll go through the title. You're modifying increases in benefits after retirement. You're requiring payment from employers with employees, and it should be or retirees in the plan. And then you're providing for potential withholding of severance tax if one of the cities participating employers fail to make the payments. You're requiring reports from the retirement system annually, and then you're providing an appropriation at the end. The staff comment notes that really the direction was simply reduce the minimum 3% to 2.1%, change it from compounded to not compounded, and work with the retirement system on the language. On page 2, line 10, we start with in addition to any other contributions, and that language is in there, although it's really not effective because they don't require contributions currently. There's just not enough active employees. Starting with this fiscal year coming up, the board assesses employers, and that's any person who has any city or county or town who has one or more members participating in the plan. And they're going to make that assessment so that it is 100% actuarially funded in 10 years at the end of fiscal year 2024. They're going to make the assessments proportionally based on the benefits paid from the plans. You take all the benefits paid as a denominator, and the numerator is whatever that participating employer is, and then that will be the fraction of the total amount of money they need.
Dave, a question on that.
Yep.
If 7 years out the plan becomes really solvent, is there a kicker in there that reduces it? And if it goes the other way, what happens after 10 years?
Mr. Chairman, we actually have that even within the 10 years that they will annually adjust the assessments.
Okay.
And that they can stop the assessments and then they can reinstitute the assessments. And this is all based upon each year's actuarial assumptions that they're using for that year right now, 7.75%, and whatever mortality table. And I think they just adopted rules where they adjust that every year. So mortality and investment returns will factor into how much the assessment is for each city.
So it could be 7 years, it could be 12. Or 9 and 11.
It could be different than that, and it's aimed at 10, and the way it's written to be aimed at 10, if you get to a point where you're at 8 or 9, and let's say they've had really bad investment returns, you'll probably have to come in and revisit this, because this is aimed at 10 year, by the end of 2024, and if the investment returns are really horrible, and now the assessments are twice what they were. Yeah, no doubt you'll want to revisit, and you'd have to revisit and change the statute.
Okay. Senator Meyer.
I mean, if we don't revisit the statute, then what would happen if you needed 3 years' contribution in the 10th year, then the assessment would come out at 3 years of contribution and to get it up to 100% if it wasn't revisited then?
Mr. Chairman, that's true. The way it's structured is really the liability falls on the cities and towns. The firemen take their hit from the 3 to 2.1%, but that's fixed. The state puts in the $23 million or whatever amount you end up saying at the very beginning. That's fixed. This is the moving part of the equation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So the only one affected by the moving part of the cities.
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm trying to get to where what we haven't already covered now. All right, Mr. Chairman, on page 3, line 4, well, line 2, these assessments are made every fiscal year. Whatever the assessment is for that fiscal year, they're payable quarterly by the cities and towns, the employers, I'll call them, and there's the dates. If they're not paid, and this is something that you didn't talk about, but it has been used before. I don't think we have any current statutes. But if they're not paid, there's a delinquent contribution. The board reports that to the state treasurer, and the state treasurer would withhold from severance tax due the amount of that delinquency. And currently, I think, and Don can correct me if I'm wrong, but currently I think that would cover any assessment that's projected as of today.
Yeah, the revenues are such that you have enough to offset. Senator Meyer.
Dave, not all of these employers get severance taxes, do they?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That would only be, cities and towns basically do, but those small, the fire improvement districts or the fire districts don't. Oh. So you're right. So there wouldn't be no provision for that. But the very next sentence, Mr. Chairman, and in current law, if there's a delinquency in the payment, the board is authorized to basically sue and get the payment plus 10% interest per year. So that would cover those employers. This is only inserted to avoid that, so that the state doesn't have to sue a city or town, that it's easier just to get the money, withhold money from them, rather than give them the money and then turn around and sue them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, continue.
All right, Mr. Chairman, page 3, line 13. And this is where I talked about it already, but the board reviews the assessment annually and adjusts the assessment as necessary to keep that 100% funding level using the board's prevailing assumptions and actuarial methods. So if they drop from 7.75% down to 7.5% for some reason, because that's where the market is, then that would have an effect on the assessment.
Okay.
Next line on line 17 is your question, Mr. Chairman. The board's authorized to discontinue the assessments and reinstate the assessments, and to continue the assessments beyond fiscal year 2024 is necessary to maintain a funding level 100%.
Yeah, what we're really doing is we're shifting decisions made by people to grant these large distributions to the retirees because the fund was so overfunded, and putting that on the backs of the cities down the road if it doesn't get there and they're still obligated to pay it. So I'm sure George has picked that up right away. Continue, please.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. On page 3, lines 21 through 23, there's a provision that the retirement system has to be included, which is that the employer doesn't have a right to seek return of the assessment. Let's say you get the 105%, and then everybody said, well, okay, we need our proportionate share of that 5%. And that you can talk to the retirement system as to why they'd want that. My thinking is if you're just a little bit over and under, well, then you make it up the next year in the assessment by reducing that to the 100%.
Okay.
And then, Mr. Chairman, page 4, lines 1 through 4, there's another report for you. This is how those reports get instituted because you want to have, your finger on the pulse.
Well, and the big deciding factor is that magic number of 7.75.
That and Mr. Chairman, mortality and different right. variations from the table.
Senator Meyer.
Dave, could we put that language in there that we had in the other bill earlier and just say that it's going to be included in the retirement board's report to the Appropriations Committee?
Mr. Chairman, you could. We don't write one bill based on perhaps you might sponsor another bill, but you can do that if that's your decision.
That might be the least controversial amendment we'll have on this one. Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, there's a staff comment, page 4, lines 5. You only addressed the 3% minimum. You didn't address the 5% maximum. And so, the staff comment notes that, well, with a goal of 100%, to go above the 3%, up to the 5%, you have to have 115% funding. Well, if your goal is 100% funding and your assessment's based on 100% funding, very unlikely you're going to hit 115%, certainly for those 10 years. I mean, you'd have to have extraordinary returns or something like that. Now, after 10 years, maybe you could get back up there. So anyway, not knowing what the committee wanted to do, we gave you two alternatives. One just keeps it at least 2.1% with 100% goal. The other is a strict 2.1%. And then, Mr. Chairman, the last really, on page 5, line 5, there's the other issue you have. Currently, the law is shall be compounded, this additional benefit, and we throw in the word shall not be compounded.
Okay.
Carrying through to page 6, line 2 is your alternative. And then page 6, line 4, I talked about that. It's not discussed, but that's through page 7, line 2, is the provision for the state treasurer to withhold severance tax payments, and it would apply only to those entities that receive that. Page 7, lines 4 through 6, that language is stating that past increases, whatever those are, you're not going to ratchet those down. Those are done, and this is on a going-forward basis. And then page 7, lines 8 through 20, the $23 million appropriation from the general fund effective July 1st, 2014. And because you won't know exactly what it is, there's some waffle language that the auditor will reduce that if necessary to hit that 100% goal. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, on page 7, line 19, if less than $23 million is needed right now to hit that 100% goal, then that money would immediately revert. So there wouldn't be money there from the state for the system to use to move up and down.
Thank you, Dave. Committee questions? Senator Perkins.
Chairman, delinquency, if you have a participant or an employer who doesn't receive severance taxes, which there are some on the list that don't receive severance taxes, then how would that? Then there's not going to be that hammer.
Well, you litigate. Go ahead, Dave.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, in the current law, there's a provision for the retirement system to collect delinquent payments, and it has a 10% interest fee per year on any delinquency if they do have to sue in district court.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to be perfectly clear. It's the entity that would have to, I mean, there's two entities that could sue if I got this right. The entity could be the Wyoming Retirement System, or it could be the plan participants. Either one of those would sue. Is that the way it would work?
Dave,
Mr. Chairman, the statute actually only talks about the retirement system suing to get the contributions.
Okay. Any other questions, committee, on the bill? Representative Wallace.
Mr. Chairman, the $23 million figure, what exactly went into arriving at that? I mean, I've got so many numbers running around in my head, I'm losing track. Sorry.
Dave?
Mr. Chairman, that Don or the retirement folks can fit, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you had your scenarios at your last meeting with a compound at 2.1%, I think it was going to be 26 point some million dollars that was needed from the state up front to hit that 100% after 10 years when combined with the additional assessments from the cities and the reduction to 2.1%. When you made that non-compounded, it was about a $3 million upfront reduction in what the state had to pay.
Follow up.
Just 1 second. Steve, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, you can actually see that figure on page 7 of the handout. Okay, that's the study 7. And if you will look at the notes at the bottom of the first chart, the ones that are blocked off there, it says if the state were to pay off the amounts listed in 6 and 7 above in one lump sum, the estimated lump sum would be $23 million.
Got it. Everybody got that?
And, Mr. Chairman, while we're on this, I want to point out one more thing, and that is these numbers will change when this actually would be implemented because we'll be working off of our new valuation that we'll do at the end of this calendar year. So every number in every one of these analyses, these studies, is going to be different than what you're looking at right here because unless we hit all of our estimated assumptions dead on. In other words, we're going to perform differently than what we have estimated how we will perform. That's going to change every number in this whole deal.
We are getting used to the fact that everything you tell us can change very quickly, Steve.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for reiterating it, though.
Just to follow up on that.
Representative Nicholas.
If there is going to be a change, what's it going? I mean, we know what the trends are. Is it going to be higher or lower?
Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that it's going to be lower, but I don't know how much.
Everybody got that? It will be lower?
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
No, Mr. Representative Nicholas, follow up? Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Who's Representative Escobel?
I almost forgot my question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, this state lump sum, currently we have it coming out of general fund money. Would our SIPA account be an account that we could use? It's a strategic small investment project account. Would that be available to actually take this money out of that account?
Don?
Mr. Chairman. The governor recommends spending the entirety of that account down to zero in his recommendation, so you would have to vote, disallow one or more of his recommendations, and then that money would be available for other expenditure.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we usually do that.
Okay. Any other questions on the bill that the committee has in front of you? Any other questions of Dave while we got him up here? Dave, I've got a question. And it's looking at it two ways. It's about obligation. And earlier today we talked about what happened in Detroit and the bankruptcy and how the courts ruled in favor of the bankruptcy, saying that the retirees are subject to being treated like a stockholder or shareholder would, and they saw that their retirement fund was worth 18% of what it was supposed to be, and that's the way it was because of the poorly managed retirement system by the city of Detroit. What I'm asking you is obligations. Everybody's going to have their own opinions about this. I know that. I'm just asking, you are our LSO staff attorney in this, so tell me what you think the state's obligations are to step up and do this. The flip side of that is in terms of obligations as taxpayers out there. What, you know, some of them may say, why are we taking general fund money for 300 individuals relative to there may not be any obligation in the first place? What kind of exposure does the state have from those people suing under that premise of that kind of litigation? Go ahead, Dave, since that's law 101, right?
Mr. Chairman, I would take that on and is two part. One is what do you have to do, and the second is what can you do?
Okay.
And let me address what can you do first. And you really didn't ask that, but it's a question that always has vexed me since the first time I saw a COLA. And I wondered, how can we do that? And in light of, you have a provision in the Constitution that says, no, it's Article 3, Section 30. No bill shall be passed giving any extra compensation to any public officer, servant, or employee, agent, or contractor after services are rendered or contract made. Now, my way of looking at that is, well, it's a bill, it's extra compensation, at least that's what I would think, to employees, services are rendered, contracts made. So I went and did a little bit of quick research. I haven't had time to look at it thoroughly, but there's an AG opinion in 2007, amazingly enough, issued by former Attorney General Crank. And
he's smiling, so I'm not sure if that's a good smile or a bad smile. Go ahead.
Well, and the question that he was presented with at that point was, when you provided the extra compensation for retiree health benefits, how can you do that in light of Article 3, Section 30, or could you do it in light of Article 3, Section 30? And I won't go through the whole opinion, but basically what it says is there are a number of courts that look at that and take a, you know, plain language reading, say, no, you can't do that with state general funds. Other courts say, no, it's not so absolute, it's not so crystal clear. The Attorney General's opinion came down on the side of saying, look, you have historically added made general fund contributions to increase retiree benefits to persons who are already retired. And I won't go through the history of it. I can, but they go through probably 15 or so appropriations where you've done that. No one's ever questioned that. No one said that that's in violation of Article 3, Section 30. So that's a summary of that opinion. And it's a formal opinion. It's out there. Anybody can read it. And I would say the same thing applies to this Fireman A. Of course, he was looking at the big plan and the Warden's plan and some other plans. But, you know, this Fireman A started in 1935. And at that time, actually it wasn't Fireman A, it was just the fireman. At that time, there was a retirement capped at $100 a month, minus any old age pension. You know, that's back before Social Security. So minus any old age pension. Obviously, those benefits have changed. Sometimes they've, and I can give you a six-page summary of it here, sometimes they've changed with contributions, increases from employers and employees, and sometimes without them. Now, the second part of your question is, what's your liability? From the get-go, the language, and it still exists, it says the account shall be administered without liability on the part of the state beyond the amount of the funds. And so that raises the question, well, if you put $23 million in here, is this just a gratuity? Is this just a gift from the state, which you can't do under the Constitution? And I can tell you that there's a Supreme Court case, and there's been a couple of them. Most famous one, I think, in 1921, where undersheriff was killed. The legislature said, here's money for the widow. The auditor wouldn't pay the money and said, hey, that's just a gift or a gratuity. The Wyoming Supreme Court said, no, the legislature can recognize a moral obligation, even if they don't have a legal obligation to do that. And so that's kind of a long answer to say, you have this statute, you've made these changes to it, and you're going to hear a lot more about it, and we can go through the history, but you know basically some of the increases have gone back and forth. You had the escalator clause. You got rid of the escalator clause. You put the 3 to 5% in there. Where a court would come out, I can't tell you. I don't think anybody can tell you, but I can tell you that there's, I think, grounds to say, oh, there's a problem with that based on those two constitutional provisions. I think there's grounds to say you have a contract that you've made, you have a moral obligation, even if you don't have a legal obligation, to make these payments. And if the legislature takes the, you know, a view of splitting it three ways, you know, I can't say what a court would do, but I could certainly see that that would be a reasonable thing to do, or a court holding that that would be a reasonable thing to do under the circumstances.
Questions? Our fellow senator who happens to practice law says maybe yes, maybe no. And I think that's a fair assessment. What about from the side of the taxpayer suing? Do you run across any cases or any law in that regard? I can understand the Fireman A retiree suing and that whole premise, depending on what we do. But what's the flip side of it with taxpayers or the cities?
Mr. Chairman, I
mean, I know anybody can sue, and I understand that, but just some legal, from your legal perspective.
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you I've not seen a taxpayer lawsuit in the Wyoming Supreme Court over a case like this.
Okay.
Whether a taxpayer would have standing or not, I don't know, and I haven't researched that, so I can't give you a good answer to that. As far as cities and towns go, I can tell you that, again, throughout the history of this thing, it wasn't always the state's obligation. You've had it from employees to employers, and you've had the state stepped in a couple times and stepped up to it, up to the plate and added money in as needed. So if the cities were to sue now on this, I couldn't tell you what
you know, the statute you referred to about we shall not have the obligation, it's right there to your left. Does that refer to cities and towns as an entity of the state, or is that strictly the state's perspective?
Mr. Chairman, it says without liability on the part of the state.
The state,
it doesn't
okay.
say anything about the cities and towns. Okay. And the final thing I'd add, and I should have said this before, it says that the account shall be administered. You know, there is an opinion from Mike Hubbard, from the Attorney General's office, when this issue came up from JEC, I think in 2009. And one of the questions was, can you do away with the increase in benefit? And the opinion says, well, you can if it's reasonable and necessary to save the fund. But at the same time, at the very end, and which is a really strange thing that they said, you know, this account is also shared with the Fireman B account, which is funded with fire insurance premium taxes. I haven't looked into that anymore, but there's an argument to be made that it's like, well, it's you have money in the Fireman B account as well, so maybe these two accounts could be commingled to pay the Fireman A obligations. I haven't looked into it. And the Attorney General opinion really, I don't think, addresses that exact question, but it does make mention of that.
Okay, and then if in fact we did nothing and this thing becomes, it just goes bankrupt in 10 years or some number out there, then the law, the exposure to the state, is it a moral obligation that we would be sued under, or would be a contractual obligation? Or, I mean, let me rephrase that. They could sue under both, but in terms of the law, the moral side is the one that we probably have the most difficult time defending. Would that be a fair assessment?
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it would be.
Okay.
I think certainly one of the claims would be that there is a contract, and the state's position might well be that the legislature had no, first of all, if they had authority to bind the legislature, future legislatures, to always pay for these benefits, you know, there might be an argument to be made that they didn't have that authority. I think they probably lose on that. But then the state would say, the statute says, clearly, we have no obligation beyond the amount of money in the funds. And so then there'd be an argument as to whether there was a contract and detrimental reliance and all those things. I don't know how that would come out. But to your point of, well, would the moral obligation be a hook to hang the state on? I think it's real clear that it's not. In that case said, a moral obligation is one that is not legally enforceable.
Which is why I suggested a third, and third. Nobody likes it, but nobody likes it bad enough to try to sue. So, okay. Any other questions of Dave? Thank you, Dave. We'd stick around if you would, please. I'd appreciate it. All right, committee, what we're going to do at this point in time is we're going to open up to public comments, and I don't know, Pat, if you've got a set procedure you want to go through. I know George has some people here, so why don't you come up and sit down, identify yourself. If you've got some comments to make, please do, and then if you have some people that want to comment, we'll do that. Then if the cities have some comments they'd like to make, we will afford you that opportunity. And then anyone else that just feels like they haven't had that chance, we'll do that. And then the committee, you know, we'll take up the bill, see if there's a motion to move it forward. If there is, then we'll look at amendments, and then ultimately we may take a vote on the bill. Pat, the floor is yours. Identify yourself, and we're welcome.
Thank you. Pat Crank here, representing the as a paid representative of the firemen, of the members of the Fireman A Retirement Fund. You know, for several years we've battled. I think for the last 4 years I've represented the Fireman A folks, and there have been moves to reduce the COLA in all four of those years, and we've battled those and successfully maintained that 3% COLA. And we did that primarily based on the testimony that we heard from Tom Williams, then director of the retirement system, who told the JAC that there was no need to do anything with regard to this fund for at least the next 10 years. And when we saw the new actuary numbers coming out over the past, I guess during last session and going into this year, the members of Fireman A understand that we probably do need to do something to maintain this retirement fund. Senator Bebout, we heard that you had suggested in the October meeting in Casper that perhaps the way to do that would be to participate a third in achieving actuarial soundness of this fund. We went to our membership, and they quite frankly agreed that would be a good way to go. And so accordingly, I can tell you that as we sit here today, we can largely support the bill that's in front of this committee, but for the removal of the compounding provisions. I think Ruth Ryerson said it again today, and I think it was said during the last meeting. If we agree to reduce the COLA to 2.1%, then the cities, the state, and the members of Fireman A who are drawing retirement benefits equally contribute to achieving actuarial soundness. You know, I had some members as I was talking to them yesterday question that, but I think that's absolutely the testimony before this body. And you know, I guess if we're all going to bleed, we should all bleed equal amounts, in my vernacular. And so the 2.1% compounded study, which is, I believe, study two that Ms. Ryerson discussed today, we can support that proposal, and we'll work as hard as possible to achieve passage of that. We do have strenuous objections to a non-compounded COLA. You know, a simple COLA to me is an oxymoron. It doesn't make sense. You know, a COLA has to compound, or every year the person who receives that COLA loses their income or their retirement income to inflation. I sent an email to the committee yesterday, and I don't know how many of you have read it, but my example was if next year we have inflation of 4% and the COLA is, I'll just round the numbers, but we have inflation of 4% and the COLA is only 2%, these folks here will have lost 2% of their retirement benefits to inflation. And if
but Pat, the flip side of that argument, you've got the big plan and all the other retirees out there that get no COLAs. And I know you understand that, and that's a different argument, but that's out there, and that's the kind of input we're getting. Please proceed.
And I do, and that's something I want to address. You know, that's kind of the 900-pound gorilla sitting in the corner of the room today. And the question is, why should you get a COLA if we're not? And I believe because this is such a dramatically different plan, and I even have probably the most important factor to argue that is from your question to Ms. Ryerson and to myself yesterday, you know, that with regard to these folks' ability to participate in Medicare. You know, the plan started in 1935. These folks have never been able to contribute to Social Security, so they received no Social Security benefits. And I'm quite frankly embarrassed, Senator Bebout, that it took a question from you to make me understand that it's even worse than I thought. You know, I always thought that's a bad deal for these folks, that they don't get a monthly Social Security check and they don't get a yearly Social Security COLA. But the fact that they don't have the ability to participate in Medicare when they become age eligible for that is a horrible detriment to them. And it shows the importance of this retirement plan and those COLA benefits and maintaining this plan to be even more important, because they didn't have the ability to do that. The other thing I would note is this plan is odd, that because when you retire, you don't retire it at the high three of your salary as the big plan presently provides for. You actually retire at a percentage of a first class firefighter salary, which is a person by definition of someone that's been there no more than 5 years and has received no promotion. So if I had progressed to chief and maybe I'm making $100,000, I don't retire at my high 3 years of salary. I retire at a percentage of the firefighter salary. So, you know, those two are, I guess those three are the three big reasons why we believe that we absolutely need a COLA, and that we're different in material respects from the big plan and the other plans where COLAs have been done away with, at least for the time being.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. Mr. Crank, I that's the first time I've heard that there are maybe a substantial number of firemen A that are Medicare ineligible. And I know that you probably, because it's a new issue, you probably don't know, have the numbers, but I would like to know how many of the 300 roughly participants are Medicare ineligible. I mean, so if that a number you can get for us between now and when we're done, that would be a useful thing to know.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, we'll try to do that. It may be something best put to, we may try to do that in conjunction with the retirement system. I mean, they have a complete and accurate list of all of our members and an ability to communicate with them that we might not have on a day-to-day basis.
Well, the other part, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just not sure that state retirement would have Medicare eligibility within their purview, but I don't know.
Yeah, the other add-on to that is the insurance that they receive, and I've never asked that question. And what type of insurance? Are they still have the opportunity under the state, or what kind of insurance? If I'm 50 years old, I'm one of the 308. What am I doing for insurance?
And Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question. I can ask that and then get it back to the committee as well.
Yeah, I think those are pretty important things, and I for one didn't realize that I understood the Social Security component, which is why I think we need to have this conversation. But the Medicare thing is another one, and it was Representative Moniz. It wasn't me. I received an email from one of his friends that had brought that up, and that's why I asked you the question. Okay, continue.
It's a great question, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas. I agree with you that the retirement system may not have the ability to may not have that information on file. But they certainly have the ability where we could inquire directly with all of those 308 people via a letter or something to get that data for the committee.
The other thing, too, Don, on that one is if Medicare, because of the 86 cutoff, I mean, then there's Medicaid, and I don't know how. I think the eligibility requirements, given the level of the income the firemen receive, they would be ineligible for any kind of Medicaid, because that number is a high number. So I think Medicaid's off the table, and so they turn 65, as I understand it, and they're saying, "What am I going to do about insurance?" Of course, you have the ACA, and we're not going to get into that, and all of that. That's a whole. Yeah, forget that I even said that. Okay, continue.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd agree with you. I think the plan closed in 1987, if memory serves me correctly, and the cutoff for having mandatory enrollment in Social Security was 86. So as Ms. Ryerson said, I doubt any of our people are drawing Social Security in this retirement plan. The other thing I want to address is
Mr. Chairman, can I interrupt before
Stubson.
We go on to one another topic? And Mr. Crank, I was just wondering on dollars and cents if you or your membership has gone in and done the math on what a average benefit looks like in 10 years in under compounding versus simple. And I did some sort of rough back-of-the-napkin calculations and came up with, like, looked like a $1,000 difference maybe in 10 years in the benefit. But I was wondering if you guys did that calculation at all.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Stubson, I have not done that calculation.
And we'll have that number. And this, like I said earlier, is long from over, so we'll have some more information. The Medicare component, I think, is critical, too. We might even look and see what the ACA might, what that might do in this situation. Okay. Any other comments, Pat?
The other thing that, as you know, as I've talked to folks over the last 4 years, Mr. Chairman, that you know, people say this is a great retirement plan, and I have to admit, as their representative, this is a very good retirement plan when you look at the benefits. Over the past weeks, though, I've heard a lot of wonderment about what happened in 1991, I guess it was, when let me make sure of that date, but you know, back in October, Mr. Chairman, October 18th, 2013, on behalf of Fireman A, I wrote all of you a letter, and I attached it's Exhibit A, and I think it's a very accurate timeline of all the significant events that have occurred with regard to this particular retirement account. But you know, in 1997, I guess, is the date I wanted to refer to. Effective July 1st, 1997, and over the objections, and I would note that there were strenuous objections of the members of Fireman A, the retirement board and the retirement director and the legislature ceased all contributions, employer, employee, and the money that had been flowing previously from the fire insurance tax to this account. And thereafter, there's actually an attorney general's opinion in 1996 written to then director Gerald Fox, who says and the question that was asked is, we have so much money in B, can we spend it other places than on B? And the attorney general said no, it has to be spent within on the members we have so much money in Fireman A, it has to be spent for benefits for the members of Fireman A. Thereafter, there are a series of increases, and that's, I've heard members of this committee express concern about that. Originally, the benefits were based on 50% of a firefighter first class salary, and then they were jumped to 55%, and then they were jumped to 57.5%, and then they were jumped to 75%. I wanted to look at that, and you know, I will tell you that those increases were suggested and recommended by the retirement system. I will tell you, you know, the firemen, I'm sure, accepted them once the legislature made those statutory changes, but those were not the ideas of at least the active firefighters who strenuously opposed ceasing contributions to the fund and increasing benefits because they recognized at that time that the place that we're at today would occur. With no contributions and increased benefits, the plan's going to run into trouble, and they tried to stop it, but they weren't listened to. You know, in the most recent study submitted yesterday, someone on this committee asked the retirement board to analyze what would have happened. And so I'm looking at the December 18th, 2013 report from the Wyoming Retirement System. And on page 9 of that report, the question was asked, what would the benefits of an average retiree be if none of those changes had been made to plan benefits? Because that sounds kind of bad, just facially, if you think that they were able to jump from 50 to 55 to 57.5 to 75. It sounds like huge increases. And so the retirement system is analyzed this for you on page 9. And basically, if you look at the year 1997, it would have resulted in approximately, you know, a $3,000 additional benefit. And if we go to 2012, the last year which we have data, that's an approximately $16,000 additional benefit. So via those increases, they receive someplace between an additional yearly benefit of $3,000 to $16,000. And I was thinking about that, and I'm thinking, well, is that horribly different than other plans that the state may administer? And I will submit to you, you know, if we take the average of those, so we're at 13,000, so we're at $6,500 average increase over those that time frame. And I looked at, I was wondering, is that much different than the other retirement plans we have? And I'll tell you, it really isn't. I mean, all that sounds like a huge increase over a short period of time, it really is not much different than what we would see in the big plan. You know, in the big plan, you're...
You know what we need to do, and we're hearing you. Ruth, you could provide us some information in regards to that, too, just to give us, so we get it, you know, opinions from two sides. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, you know, in the big plan, the retirement is based on the employee's high three years of salary. So, as I understand it, a 30-year employee gets 2.1875% of his high 3 years, and that's the percentage at which he retires. So if I do that math, I'm at 65%. So if an employee in the big plan received a $10,000 a year raise and maintained that for 3 years, his yearly benefit under the big plan would be increased by 65% times that $10,000, or $6,500. Roughly the same benefit increase you saw that Fireman A experienced after the plan was found to be so flush that we needed to increase benefits. In my experience as the Attorney General, it was not that unusual that at least my attorney staff would receive a $10,000 raise at some period of time while they were working for me as they jumped from attorney level to attorney level. So looking at it from that perspective, even though it sounds bad, I think when you look at it and you think about the actual numbers, that, you know, that resulted in approximately a $6,500 yearly benefit increase for these folks. It happens all the time in the other plans, and it's not as outlandish as it sounds at first blush.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. Mr. Crank, I've got a question. And if you go to the that December most recent, I think it is 16th, it's dated December 18th, but and if you go to page 8, and it has a hypothetical contributions to paid to Fireman's A plan 97 through 2003. Do you see that?
You're on page 8?
That's correct.
And what line are you?
It's the first bar chart there. And what I'm interested about is, first of all, if you look at that, and what this is what the average fireman would have paid if the they considered continue to pay their 8% salary through 2013. And the fireman, the average fireman would have paid in $2.1 million. And then it has employer contributions, which would be the various employers that are listed, the 11 or so. They would have paid in $5.7 million. And the contribution by the state is $6.1 million plus $21 million, which is a total of $27 million. And so it would appear to me that if you were going to have a fair distribution of what the contribution was of the various parties, it wouldn't be a third, a third, a third. It would be based upon the percentage of what each entity paid in. And that would essentially mean the state would be responsible for over 85% of whatever the unfunded liability is. What's the Fireman's A position on why the city should be bounced up to a third when they weren't even contributing a third at this time?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, these numbers here are horribly deceiving because, look at the time frame. This is from 97 to 2013. The numbers of act, and so I assume these numbers are based on the number of active firemen that are serving during those time frames. By 97, the number, I don't have the exact number, but you're going to have a small, you're going to have a small number of active firemen and a large number of retirees. So that will drive down what the active firemen would have paid via their contributions. It will drive down what the city would have paid, the cities would have paid via their contributions. And the $21 million was not paid to Fireman's A, that was paid to Fireman's B. Because after 1997, those contributions, those insurance proceeds were seized. I mean, there were no contributions to this fund after 1997.
Yeah, I understand.
Representative Nicholas.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that you were right, except for the last statement, because this the $21 million is the 1% tax that was on the fire insurance premium tax, and that's what they ended. But at the time in 1997, that's how much was being paid into the Fireman A fund through the premium tax, in addition to the 6.1% that the states were contributing directly. So you combine those, and out of the $35 million being contributed, 27 or almost $28 million was being contributed basically by the state.
Well, Mr. Crank.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, I beg to differ. I mean, with all due respect, this says fire insurance premium tax paid to the volunteer fire plan. That's not us. The $21 million did not go into our retirement account.
Maybe we can have a clarification.
Representative Nicholas. Could we make sure we work this conversation through the chair.
Could we have Mr. Summers direct on this issue, and just to make sure we're talking on the same apples and apples?
Go ahead, Steve, if you have some
Mr. Chairman, what the $21 million represents is the actual amount that was distributed to the Vol Fire account from 97 to 2013. But the assumption here is that had that been continued to be paid into Fire A plan from 97 to 2013, it would have resulted in an additional $21 million being paid into paid Fire A plan. That's
so
what
this,
that represents.
Yeah, it ceased in 97, was redirected to the volunteer,
right,
where it still is today, and that's about $1 million a year, roughly.
Million and a half or so.
Million and a half. And so that's the number that would have been.
Right. The point of this analysis, Mr. Chairman, was to say, okay, had we kept the current contribution rates in place, the 8% on firemen, 20% on employers, 22.5% on the state, and we had kept the 50% of the fire insurance premium taxes flowing into this plan over this time frame, the total amount would have been an additional $35 million.
Right.
This is a hypothetical.
And just a question, that is just straight cash, not any growth in that those deposits over time or any of that.
That's right.
And so, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on
Representative
that,
Nicholas.
And so had we been doing that, would it be a fair representation to say that the fund would be sound right now?
I don't think
so. Maybe you can think about that retirement board and get back to us on that one. And I stepped out, I apologize. Steve, what are we talking about? We eliminated the premium insurance tax that was going to this in 97, right? Isn't that what we did?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas had a line of question on page 8 about these hypothetical contributions and really about the state's large share of that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, I guess the other thing I would note is with regard to the employer contribution on page 8, I think the more accurate figure that you may want to look at, assuming this hypothetical has relevance to the questions you're answering, the more accurate figure may be what did the employers pay to Fireman B during that same time frame, because then you'll be looking at what an active, full-bodied, non-closed system might have contributed to this plan if those rates had stayed as they were. You know, the problem with this number, I think, and making many judgments about it, is there were so few active firefighters, you know, left that number was never going to generate a large amount. The other thing I would point out, Representative Nicholas, is that the cities have paid, have contributed to this fund only 53% of the time this fund has been in existence. And historically, for the large number of years, they paid at a very low rate. So it was the way it was set up, and it was a good thing for the cities. But the state has in large part caused this retirement account to even be there and make the contributions to allow these folks to draw retirement. The city's had a free ride for a long time, and if you run the numbers, it's 53% of the time they've not even contributed to the fund since it's been in existence.
Now, I was trying to remember 97 when the plan looked so actuarially strong and we were trying to help the volunteer firemen out. That might have been why that happened legislatively in 97. But I can't remember. Okay, is that about it, Pat? We're going to try to move on. You got anything else?
Yeah, as I was trying to listen to the numbers, and Steve can help me out, but the difference between study two.
Compound and non-compound.
Compound and
non-compound. Not a lot of money.
I mean,
depending on who you are.
The cost difference in that was what, 3 to 6 million?
3.2 to 3.6.
Excuse me?
It was 3.2 million or roughly 3.6 for the city side only. That's what it was.
So we'd be talking about a total
400,000 a year
additional cost to the state and the cities of about $6 million, $7 million. You asked Mr. Groover a series of questions about the legality of all this. I would note that from our perspective, a promise is a promise, and we believe that that there is a better than even chance, and in fact a strong chance, that if the firefighters A were to challenge any reduction of the COLA, that under either a contract clause analysis or a civil rights analysis, that they might prevail in court, recognizing how poor of a choice litigation is to solve disputes. We want to work with the legislature, we want to work with the cities, we want to work with the state, and so we're willing to forego a portion of our COLA to achieve actuarial soundness. As I said at the start of this, I am, on behalf of the Firefighter A folks, I can tell you that we are approve this bill. I do not, Mr. Groover discussed over on page 5 of the bill that you could do an alternative fix and remove the 3 to 5% language that currently exists in the statute. We would oppose that. We don't think that's necessary. We think we might as well leave that, and maybe one day, God willing, this fund will be flush and they could go to a higher COLA than a 2.1% than would be set by this bill. So we'd like to leave that language in the bill. Our real opposition is
on
over
COLA.
On page...
Yeah, we know where it is, the compounded part.
It's just the compounding. Just strike that added language and leave it as it exists, and we would wholly support that bill and would urge one of the members of this committee, if the bill comes up today, to make such an amendment, and then we could be fully supportive of the bill. Mr. Chairman, I know I've gone on and on, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have or the committee might have.
Thanks, Pat. We appreciate it. Any questions of Pat?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dockstader. For Senator Dockstader, excuse me.
Mr. Crank, before you step down, I didn't track you like I wanted to when you said this is a dramatically different plan from all this. We're going to break some ground here with a COLA. I'd like you to just give us a summary statement of why we're doing this.
Pat?
Why our plan is different and justifies a COLA?
Yes.
First off is the inability to participate in Social Security. Every year where there's inflation, Social Security awards a COLA. I think this, for the past several years, there hasn't been a COLA because there's been no inflation to justify it. But this year there will be, I think I read in the paper, a 2.3% COLA awarded to Social Security benefits, or Social Security folks who receive Social Security benefits. We have no ability other than this COLA in this plan to guard against inflation. And the other oddity about this is we didn't start at a high 3 level. This, it's different than any other plan in the fact that a retiree doesn't start at his high 3 levels of salary. he starts at a percentage of a five-year firefighter salary. So these folks, when they decide to retire, go much farther backwards than your average retiree would, and so they need that COLA to continue to maintain against inflation and to recognize the fact that they're not starting at some percentage close to where they retired from. And I believe that'd be my summary, Senator Dockstader.
Senator Dockstader, that take care of that one. Okay. President Nicholas.
Just one thing more, Mr. Chairman. It's interesting, you know, because we're discussing, Mr. Chairman, a $68 million unfunded liability. Mr. Subson and I were trying to calculate what the COLA would have been between 2004 and 2012, and it's about $1,000 a year difference between a compounded versus an uncompounded. So in the big picture, I don't know if that's going to be a whole lot of money just for another 10 years compared to, and I think the number circulating right now is $6 million overall, but it's just an interesting component of
yeah, what we're going to do is I think the WRS is going to provide that because, like I said, this is long from over. Any questions of Pat? Pat, do you have some people that would like to have a comment? And we want to give everybody a chance to have their say if they want to, but I would appreciate, you know, not repeating the same thing, but we're going to give the latitude to these people that have traveled. So, you know,
Mr. Chairman,
at it and get them up here if they want to say something.
Mr. Chairman, I'll leave that up to them. If they want to speak, they're more than welcome, and they're bold people. I think they may come up and have some comments for you. My last comment would be that Attorney General in 2007 was really a smart guy, so you should follow that.
Yeah, we're not going to allow editorial comments. So if there's such a thing as stricken from the record, we might do that.
Mr. Chairman,
is there any of you that we've heard from you before in Casper, but we still want to, there's somebody that wants to say something, you know, please feel free. We'd love to hear from you. And
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
I think there's a mic. Yeah, Pat, if you could
pass
that around.
Folks don't have to.
This room isn't the most conducive. You don't have to get up and trip over each other in the back row. And
anybody want to testify? Anybody?
Mr. Chairman? While Pat's holding the mic, I still had one
Reverend
more question.
Reverend Escobel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And then, Pat, did you also take some input from the surviving spouses? I guess there's like 50 surviving spouses that get this benefit. And I know back in the day we didn't have the two working parents like we do a lot of families today. You know, the man was pretty much the sole wage earner. Imagine a lot of these surviving spouses aren't covered under Medicare either.
You know, our Mr. Chairman, excuse me, and Representative Escobel, our organization represents both those surviving spouses as well as the living firefighters and their spouses that will have eligibility in the system. You know, I would assume the same may apply. I will, you know, to the surviving spouses, they may or may not be eligible for Medicare or, you know, sometimes I believe, and I think we need more information on this, but sometimes your spouse could make you eligible for Medicare coverage if they have enough quarters of service, but that's pretty speculative on my part. But
no, that's true. That's accurate. Okay. Anything else? I guess nobody wants to testify. I want to thank all of you for coming. And now anyone else? George, would you like to testify? And if you have some, are there anybody here from any specific cities that want to testify? Okay, great. We'll hear from you. Please identify yourself. You know the drill. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm George Parks with the Wyoming Association of Municipalities. And we really appreciate the time that you're putting into this because it's an important and a really difficult issue. And I would say it boils down to three decisions. What will the benefit be going forward? And then you'll have a discussion about the responsibility for where we are now and how we got here. And then the question of it's going to take some more money. Where's that going to come from? Over what kind of time frame? Those are really in a nutshell. And the bill that's before you does some good things. It addresses the question of the benefit going forward. we don't have a position on what that ought to be. We respect that that's a very difficult thing to deal with. Well, that's a hard question. And then the bill goes, the one thing in the bill that we believe is a positive thing, and that is it has the state injecting a substantial amount of money to help solve the problem. We think that has to be a part of the mix. We have given you a short memo with some bullet points about what we think the major, kind of the major ideas are. But, Mr. Chairman, I would say this. Going back to 1981, when Fire A was closed, the employers, and I specifically speak for the cities and towns who are part of the system, have relied on the state in the person of the retirement system and the legislature to manage the system well. Whether that's written in a contract or what, but I can tell you we relied on the state to manage it well. And with the wonders of hindsight, you know, we can say, well, there were some decisions made that have contributed significantly to the shortfall that we have now. And I almost say, well, so what? You know, you make a lot of decisions. Nobody expects all the decisions to be perfect. And, you know, if they turn out to not be very good decisions, well, you know, that happens in the business of governing. So it's not personal, and we regard the legislature as partners in governing. We regard the state agency and the retirement system as partners in doing what we need to do, and we don't want to be at odds with either body. But I would say this, the cities and towns, fulfilled all the obligations they were required to. They paid the premiums when they were supposed to. And we are aware that, as was pointed out in the newest handout on page 8, that the city and town, or the employers, did not have to pay $5.7 million over the period of years as a result of the decision to discontinue contributions from everyone. Other than that, from this perspective, we have difficulty seeing that the employers are responsible for the mess that we're in. Now, there's an unknown, and it's a question that you've asked about, said, if they had not discontinued contributions, if they had just continued, where would we be today? And it's certainly possible somewhere in that time frame you might have found out additional contributions were necessary. You don't have that information yet, but that probably ought to be part of the discussion. But we recognize cities and towns do not have to pay $5.7 million over this period of time. If the ultimate decision is that, well, let me say this. I don't think there's anything wrong with the state now deciding. We made the decisions. We accept responsibility for that. We are going to decide what the future benefit is going to be, and we're going to take care of it because we made the decisions. Now, if you want to say cities and towns save some money, so you've got to pay some back in recognition of those savings, you know, well, we could at least understand that line of thinking. We've heard you say that you want to get some more information about how many people are eligible for Medicare, how many people are eligible for Social Security, because that's another, you know, that is another part of the discussion. And so we encourage you to do that, and as I said, we appreciate you being thorough with how you're going about this. The mechanism in the bill that, the allocation that the employers should be responsible for half of the remaining financial obligation it takes to make this healthy, we believe that's excessive because we didn't make the decisions. And it far exceeds the money that we saved. And the mechanism...
Yeah, and what we need to know is know that number so we can get a little bit into your head about where you're coming from. So could you provide that to us when you get a chance?
Mr. Chairman, the number...
Yeah, the difference between what we're asking you to do and what you think you should have paid.
Mr. Chairman, we can have that discussion, and we'll work on that. We appreciate the system doing that calculation to come up with the $5.7 million that's been saved. That's a helpful piece of information. The mechanism in the bill that requires or that has a 10-year target, in our opinion, may be too aggressive. This is at least a 17-year problem going back to 1997. It could be that a longer time frame would be more workable. The people from the cities who are here can talk a little bit about the resources that they have to go back and pay for something that they thought was taken care of. And that, you know, that's another part of the discussion. The state clearly has the resources to do however much of this you want. As you know, cities and towns have a much different resource situation when it comes to the financial resources.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we did that, if we extended the payment time out beyond the 10 years, that would significantly change the actuarially soundness of what we're trying to do here, would it not?
Yeah, the amortization. You're saying a 15-year amortization instead of 10. Go ahead, George.
And certainly that's correct. I mean, the numbers are the numbers, and compounding is compounding. But I'd say this is not a problem that was created in a short time. And frankly, you know, we're glad it's being addressed now. We wish it had been addressed 4 years ago. It probably would have, but that's water under the bridge. So, and finally, Mr. Chairman, I think the lesson learned for everyone is that a closed plan, a closed-end plan, is a tricky animal. And I know you have another. You're looking at another possibility of closing the plan. And of course, we all wish we knew then what we had known now. But this is a tricky thing. And as I said, the essence of our difficulties with some of the discussion so far is we relied on the state to manage this and manage it well. And hindsight, should have been done differently. But, okay. Mr. Chairman, there are folks here from the, as far as the largest one in the room, the city of Cheyenne. Lois Huff, the city treasurer, is here, and, you know, they're the second largest local government employer in the system. We also have the city of Sheridan mayor and the human resources director from the city of Gillette. Gillette is a party to this because they are one of the partners in the Campbell County fire system. So,
okay, before we get to them, any questions of George?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
George, you know, I wasn't around when they made a lot of these changes. Maybe you were. I can't remember when you got in this business, whether we got in at the same time or not. But it seems as if at some point in time you had city employees, and the cities at that time didn't have the resources to manage their retirement for these employees. And the state stepped in as a partnership. And for a good number of years prior to these decisions made in 97 and subsequently after that, it's been a partnership to basically augment the resources of those particular cities. Would that be a fair statement, or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I have no personal knowledge of that. I've read the same report I think you have probably seen, that in 1981, when the state took the system, that it was necessary for the state to kick in some money to make the plan healthy.
Yeah.
But that's in that report. So.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, George, is there any other relationship we have like that? I know the federal government has a lot of relationships with us where we have federally funded employees or partially funded employees. Is there any other place in city government where that occurs, where we have partially state-funded employees?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, the only thing I know of that comes close to that, and I do have experience with this, was when the state took over the local police pension systems, and the state injected a fair amount of money to bring those up to par, but they also brought the expertise of the retirement system, and I think the sense was pension systems are difficult enough that these are things we ought to manage at the state level, where we have a professional staff and we have economies of scale, rather than being left to the locals. And I frankly think that's a good decision, because this is difficult business. But that's the only analogy that I'm aware of that comes close to what you're describing as police pension.
Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. Would you get your people up here, please?
Just
1 second. Senator Hastert.
George, what did you say as far as the resources the cities would have that are affected by this? And I guess there's probably not anybody here to speak to the fire districts, but specifically just to you then, as what did you say about the resources, the ability or inability? I wasn't clear on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, running a fire department and all the associated costs are essentially general fund expenditures for any city. The money that goes into a general fund is sales tax is the biggest source, and severance tax is a piece, and federal mineral royalty. The local 8 mil property tax, all of that mix of general fund revenues is what a city or town has available. If you look at the list of local employers in here, their financial strength has a broad span. And of course, that's one of the difficulties, is that whatever the remedy is has to be something that the least able of them can manage. That's a consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lois Huff, and I'm the city treasurer for the city of Cheyenne. Thank you. I would just like to reiterate, thank George for his comments here, and I would just like to maybe address the ability to pay. I just would like to give you a little bit of information about the city that I know I'm most familiar with, City of Cheyenne. As George indicated, we would pay for this obligation out of our general fund, would be the source of funding that we have. Currently, the City of Cheyenne has approximately $6 million of undesignated unassigned reserves in our general fund. We have a $50 million annual general fund budget, so we have less than 43 days in reserves in our general fund. We have limited ability, as you're aware, to raise additional revenue in our general fund. Sure, we can try to increase the sales taxes coming into our community, but I can tell you over the past years that hasn't raised significantly, and our expenditures have gone up substantially during that time period. In our last fiscal year budget, we did end up budgeting a deficit of about $265,000. Our general fund obligations for just operating expenditures were more than the revenues that we could bring in our general fund, and we ended up taking that out of basically our reserves, which are limited anyway. So when I look at our obligation in these scenarios, range on the two, depending whether it's compounded or simple, on the 2.1%, range from about $983,000 a year to $1.1 million a year. That's about 2% of our general fund budget, and I right now, as the city treasurer, am at a loss as to how we would fund that without substantially cutting services, which in a general fund of a municipality where approximately 80% of your expenditures are probably personnel related, we're talking people, to save that kind of money and make that kind of an obligation. I understand the 10-year and the compounding and how it just gets worse the longer this goes on. But if we could extend the payments, if the cities and towns are asked to fund our share of this, certainly extending the payments would help in that respect for the cities. You know, on page 8 of the, and maybe I don't understand the number that's been provided here, but on page 8 of the December 18th report that you received, where it had the employer contribution at $5.7 million, if I understand that had the decision not been made by the decision made outside of the municipalities, we had nothing to do, in our opinion, with the decision that was made to stop these contributions. So had those continued, it looks like we would have been paying $5.7 million since 1997 as the 9 entities that are listed here. And that is substantially less than what you're asking us, which is approximately, I guess, $23 million, something like that.
That gets to the question I asked George, the difference. I got it.
And yep. So I may not understand that number correctly, but if that's the case, then okay. That, and you know, if that's the case, I can say we can probably afford $5.7 million more than we can afford $23
million.
Okay. So let's see. Oh, and we also, Representative Nicholas asked for some information, and we would also be interested to know how many of the current members of this Plan A are receiving Social Security or Medicare. I am aware of 2 Plan A members that retired from the city of Cheyenne that came back to work for the city of Cheyenne and did pay into and are receiving Medicare and Social Security benefits. I'm aware of 2. Now, I don't know, I would be interested what that number would be. So I know that some of these members are collecting Social Security and Medicare. And we would also be interested in another, I believe it was Representative Nicholas that asked the question about the difference in the different plans in the big plan on the benefits that someone gets based on their highest 3 years of salary versus the benefit that a Plan A member was getting on the 50%. We would be interested in that number too if that was provided. But I'd be glad to answer any questions. But I guess the bottom line for the cities and for the city of Cheyenne that I can speak for is the ability to pay.
Would you, one thing for me, if you would, you mentioned the $6 million you had in some kind of a reserve.
Yes.
Just some follow-up information to get to me. I show on YoStar, Cheyenne City Treasurer, $18.6 million, account number 853. So if you could just provide the information to the committee, the differences in what yes. that $18.6 million is.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The money that we hold in our YoStar is from our fifth penny account. We assess a fifth penny of sales tax in Laramie County, and we hold that money for our road projects. 80% of that goes to roads, 20% goes to other agencies, and that is the money that's collected on our fifth penny. That's not to be used for general fund obligations.
Right, Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Several things here, or just a couple anyway, that I'm interested in what impact this was going to have on your public safety, accounts or your public safety for the city of Cheyenne to start with.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, through you. Out of our $50 million budget in our general fund, approximately $12 million is for our fire operations. Approximately $10 million is for our police operations. So out of the $50 million, about $22 million goes to public safety. I can't say exactly how it would affect that. Our fire obligation is a collective bargaining unit. We're bound by the obligations on an annual basis through our collective bargaining. So we would be limited somewhat in what we could do in that area. I don't know what the decision of our governing body will be if we're required to pay this. How, you know, in what section of the budget will we cut?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we got to move along. Go ahead, Senator Astor.
It's just you mentioned that you know of 2 employees that, and if I want to understand this correctly, came back to work. They were former firefighters, came back to work for the city in another capacity, and in that capacity then were able to pay in and receive now Social Security and Medicare benefits. But it would be fair to say that during their time as firefighters, my understanding is firefighters don't pay into the Medicare.
Mr. Chairman.
Or Social Security, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. But I think the statement was earlier made that a lot of these, when we're discussing the amount of the COLA that's required, is because they don't have an ability to be in Medicare and Social Security. They don't have that ability, or they didn't have that ability maybe while they were Plan A, but they have had that ability since they retired from the Plan A and have taken another job after they retired.
Okay, we understand that. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to... You mentioned your budget. I didn't write it down. $50 million. Now, that doesn't count the funding from the legislature. Last year, we funded, I think, $155 million. The governor has proposed $175 million. And so that's not included in that, I'd guess. And your share of that has been, what, I don't know, City of Cheyenne proper?
Mr. Chairman, through you, the $50 million does include the appropriation that was given to us during the biennium. We received $3.9 million from the state from the original $135 million, 60% of which was a direct distribution. So the $3.9 million is included in that $50 million. We received an additional $1.9 million last year that were additional restrictions were put on the use of that. The $1.9 million is not included in that $50
million. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your comment.
Good afternoon. Dave Kinski, City of Sheridan. I was listening to the discussion about reserves. It reminded me when I had accounting class in college and the professor was looking at this particular company and he said, there are some companies that don't have enough reserves to get through a bad quarter. He said, in this particular company, they don't have enough reserves to get through a bad Thursday. And that's kind of the way we feel at the City of Sheridan. Our situation is fairly perilous. We've been through layoffs. We've lost a third of our general fund revenue. Our employees are now paying 20% of their health insurance, and the civilian employees half their pension. Having said that, I do recognize that we all own a piece of this problem and that we're going to be having these conversations for many years to come as these pension fund issues continue to surface. What I would like to suggest for your consideration is that it should not be a three-way split discussion, but perhaps a four-way split discussion. I've had my staff take a look at the fire plan, and we frankly are puzzled why there's this distinction between fire plan A and fire plan B. And I think one of the speakers alluded to that. Fire plan A is underfunded. Fire plan B, all part of the same fund, is overfunded. So what is the picture when you look at those two combined? That's the first thought. The second thought is, when you start looking at the sustainability of Fire Plan B and consider that you have many active workers out there who potentially could make an additional contribution to provide for the sustainability of what is one fund, not two, now you're looking at a four-way cut. And so we get to, that's not an easy solution for anybody, but you can spread the pain a little bit more widely, and sometimes in these situations that's about the best you can do. The other thing I'd like to do is I'd like to push back just a little bit against the suggestion that the cities and towns had a windfall or a benefit because they weren't paying into Plan A since 1995 or 96. I can't speak for any other towns, but the city of Sheridan, under the collective bargaining mandatory arbitration process mandated by the legislature, the firefighters union in Sheridan said, look, you don't have to make that fire plan A contribution anymore. You've got a windfall. Pay 100% of our pension now. And the city lost that in binding arbitration, and we've never been able to change it yet. We're in arbitration now, again, for the third time, trying to get that changed. But insofar as the union in Sheridan was concerned, it was all one plan, not two.
What was the dollar amount on that? Do you have that number?
I can get that for you.
Would you please?
You bet. Thank
you. Any question? And you're the mayor?
I'm the mayor of Sheridan.
Thank you, Mayor, for being here.
I probably should have said that.
Well, we assumed you were Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mayor, those two plans are separate, and I guess we did hear some earlier testimony about the legalities of going into getting people from Plan A to help out with this current problem we have with this plan. So it sounds like from what I heard from our city treasurer and from you that we would have to compromise public safety by going forward with the current legislation we have. Would, would you say that your public safety in Sheridan would be compromised?
Mayor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. We will find a way. It would be helpful if footnote G, which is part of the supplemental direct appropriation, were modified to allow us to tap into that for some portion of this. Currently, footnote G says that the supplemental can only be used for one-time projects, and our auditor interprets that as capital use only, no general fund use. I think it says it can't be used for increases in wages, salaries, benefits. It'd be helpful if that were loosened up a little bit so that we could tap a little bit of that supplemental distribution. We hope that the economy will turn around. We've been saying that for 5 years. It hasn't happened yet, but when we see a little bit of daylight, we had hoped that we might be able to help our employees out who've gone without a raise, but we'll find a way. I mean, it'd be nice if the 300 could be reduced to 200, if it could be stretched out over more than 10 years, and it would be very helpful. I'm not seeing what I heard one of the speakers say is I have not yet looked at, he was a Wyoming retirement system, I've not yet looked at why we treat A and B as two separate and distinct funds. I've had my staff look at it, one of whom was on the LSO for 10 years. He said he sees no distinction in why they shouldn't be treated as one. And that may have a significant, my understanding is B is regarded as overfunded to the tune of 107%. I don't know what the size of that fund is. And you have more active employees. So I think if we're looking at sustainability, we may be looking to asking those folks to help out and make it a four-way split, and that would help everybody preserve their public safety program and their pensions.
Okay. Any other questions? One thing about that, Mayor, in your collective bargaining agreement, if, in fact, we were to go into Plan B and your firemen are in Plan B now that are already there, would that create some further negotiations and binding arbitration issues for you?
Senator, no. My suggestion is that you might look at an override assessment on the current employees as well as the city to help with the viability of both plans.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you for making the trip down. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Welcome. Identify yourself. Floor
is
yours.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Aguirre, Director of Human Resources for the City of Gillette, which is a part of the Campbell County Fire Board with the Town of Wright. I'm not going to reiterate or restate any of the things that Mr. Parks or the City of Cheyenne or Casper has put out in the interest of time, but I would like to point out that the Wyoming Retirement System Board has had the responsibility and the obligation to manage these funds for all of our cities and towns. I heard Senator Meyer mention the word partnership, and that's probably one of the most effective ways to manage a retirement plan. But unfortunately, our cities and towns don't get reports on the health of the fund very often. In fact, what we have here is the response of what we're looking at, having all the cities and towns pick up the tab for the management of the Wyoming retirement system by the board. We had no input in that. We didn't have any type of discussions. It wasn't something that happened quite often where the cities and towns were involved with the retirement system board. Throughout these years, especially since 1997, and as Mr. Park pointed out, we did not have any input or decision or authority to lay that out. I heard the term liability falls on our cities and towns. We have 99 cities and towns, the majority of which are very small cities and towns. Their budgets are tight. I've heard from a couple of these cities and towns who they're not sure how they will do this. And I heard the numbers that numbers will change. And that how does a city or town really budget or manage their services to the city's citizens of each city and town if we don't know what the number is, we don't know what the target is. So what I would ask, and again, I'm not going to, I do support everything that WAM and Cheyenne and Casper has stated as far as how we get to where we are. The burden of the underfunding should not be borne by the, should be borne by the agency for responsible for the city, the funding or the underfunding. It shouldn't be borne by our cities and towns. They don't have the authority, they don't have the capability to do that. And some of them, if they have to hit that $1 million a year to do that, may end up with laying off staff. And when you lay off staff, you cut services to our citizens, and that's really what we're here for. So I would ask that the committee, and I do thank you for looking at this. This is one tough thing to tackle, and it is going to be very hard. I think we have a long road to get there. And I would ask you to your support in protecting the financial stability and interest of our Wyoming cities, towns, and counties.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for making the trip. Anybody else? Cities, towns, and counties. Okay. Anybody else on any part of this? Anybody else? Okay, we're going to close public testimony. And procedurally, what we're going to do, committee, is Representative Moniz has declared a conflict on the voting side of that. A motion to accept the bill we have in front of us certainly is in order. Amendments are in order. The amendment, if amendment is proposed, the chair has taken the position that a 6-5 vote, regardless of which body you're in, that amendment will pass. However, on the final vote, it will require, you know, majority from both bodies. That consistent with our rules, Don?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr.
Chairman, just a quick question, and that's the majority of elected, so it'd have to be 4 on the House side, even with Representative Moniz's recusal.
Mr. Chairman, the rule says a majority of the full membership of each side.
Okay, so 4 of 7. Thank you.
Okay, so we understand that. So I have a motion. Senator Meyer moved. Do I have a second? Okay, it's been moved and seconded on the bill as presented. Everybody's heard the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have an amendment on page 5. It deals with the page 5, line 5, Mr. Chairman, members. It deals with the compounding versus the simple COLA issue. And so the amendment would be to strike the new language, reinsert the old language. I believe, is there another piece of that?
Yeah, there is.
Dave, I think it's at the top of page 6, line 1, would also be strike the new language.
Second. Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Discussion? You know, I'm going to vote no on that. I think that we've come a long ways here. And when I look at the situation that's presented by all sides, I think that, you know, we're going from 3 to 2.1. I think the people in the firemen have stepped up, and I appreciate what they've done. I just think that shouldn't be compounded, and there's a lot of arguments for that. So, anyway, anybody else have any comments? Okay, I'm going to ask for a show of hands. All in favor, raise your hand. Opposed, raise your hand. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That fails. Okay,
Mr.
Any
Chairman,
other amendments?
I have an amendment. And if I can get
okay, while they're passing that out, explain it, would you please?
Okay.
And move the amendment first.
Move the amendment.
Okay, I'll second it.
The amendment eliminates the COLA completely. I think there's a lot of basis for this. I've seen some of the legal opinions. I've read them. I think there's a constitutional matter with it. Additionally, no one else gets a COLA. The idea here is to maintain the main body, the basis of the retirement payouts to everyone. The alternative, I believe, do nothing and let the plan go broke in 11 years. And that really affects the people that are still paying into the plan. While there are only less than a dozen of them, they could look forward to practically nothing. So I would move that to eliminate the COLA.
Yeah, and just a question so we understand the amendment. You're going to repeal the COLA provision, but what about the actuarial soundness? Is there any – I see where you've changed the budget from $23 million to $7.15. Is that to pay off the actuarial soundness required to make the funds sound? Is that what you're doing with that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So that would be split between the cities and towns and the state? Is that what that does?
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, everybody understand that? Any discussion, further discussion on the motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Haskell.
I'm going to vote no on this, and it's I believe in what some of the comments that were made here that the deal was made. The individuals base their retirement, their time off, their time that they left on what they had in front of them at the time. And we're dramatically changing that. I know that if I was going to retire today from FMC, that I'm basing my retirement on what was promised me at this time and basing my financial future on what I had there. They did that at that time. I think it's I don't think it's fair that we do that and just change that, and I'm voting no on that.
Okay. Any other discussion? Chairman Burkhart?
With that matter, most private retirement plans, once you retire, what you get is what you get. There are no COLAs. Companies don't come back in and say, we want to give you more money. For a number of people, even in the legislature, their retirement's what they plan for, not what someone else gives them, and it's the person's responsibility to plan for the future, knowing that inflation's going to increase, there'll be additional expenses and that. And I don't feel a COLA is warranted for any retirement plan.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I think we heard from our council, too, about promises made and promises kept. And the real problem with comparing these to a private situation, really, we don't ask folks in the private sector to come out in the middle of the night and run into a burning house or pound on your chest when you're having a heart attack at 4 in the morning. It's about a service part. It's a service to our communities that folks have enjoyed for years and years and years, and that's part of the price we pay to live in a society like this, and it's part of public service. So I think it'd be a disservice. I'd hope we'd vote no on this amendment.
Further discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, that fails. Back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Wait a minute. Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. And I've got a proposal, but before I do it, I'd like to ask Mr. Summers a question going to, because I'm looking for a percentage, going to page 8 on the hypothetical contributions paid to firefighters if the plan had remained in effect. My question to you is what percentage of the total contributions over that period of time, 97 through 2003, was the employer or the cities and fire departments responsible for? I think I've come up with about 24 or 25%, but is that accurate, or do you have that figure?
Steve, you got that?
Mr. Chairman, we did a calculation earlier today, and if you look at the total $35 million that would have been paid had all the parties been paying at the time that had continued to pay at the time it was discontinued, the state would end up picking up about 77% of that $35 million.
Mr. Chairman, what percentage then would the employer be paying of that over the 77%?
We didn't do that. We can do that real quick, Mr. Chairman. If somebody's got a calculator, just divide 36 by 35 and you'll have it.
Divide what by what?
Divide 35.1 by... or divide 5.7 million by 35.1 million.
We're going to have a coach and an engineer both give you these numbers.
16.2%. Yeah. That's what the cities would have paid.
Mr. Chairman, then thank you, Mr. Summers. My motion would be to modify this bill so that the amount paid by the cities is not, and if you go to page 6, it wouldn't be a... withhold a comparable amount that the state was paying, so a 50-50 split. It would be essentially 20% of what of the 35 million or that obligation. So in other words, we're going to have 80% picked up by the state, whatever that number is. Instead of 23 million, it's going to be 30 some million, and then the 20% would be what the obligations of the state to pay. The employers would pay. Someone might help me articulate that better.
Saying instead of 50-50, you're saying 80-20.
That's correct. Only as between the employee,
yeah, the
state and the cities and counties. And I don't add in the firemen, because by going from 3% down to 21%, they're already kicking in the equivalent of over $20 million as their quid pro quo. So.
And we understand it. You know, I'm real hesitant to do a conceptual motion, but I think with this is pretty straightforward. And Mr. Co-Chair, if it's okay with you, everybody understand the concept, and then we'll have language. And if some reason the language is different than what we thought, we will do a thing over the phone to clarify it. So let me go over one more time. What you're asking us to do is to change the bill so that 80% of the obligation is funded by the state, 20% is funded by the cities and towns based on their pro rata share, as shown by case number two, and then the volunteer firemen go with, or not the volunteer firemen, but the firemen eight people go with the 2.1 that's in the bill, correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins?
You said study two, but study two was the compound 2.1. The bill as it stands now would be study one.
I was just referring to the breakdown on the cities in that regard.
I'd second that.
Okay, we have a motion, a move, and a second. Everybody understand it? Everybody understand the motion, which means the state's share will go up by how much, roughly, Don? Instead of $21 million, it'll be about 30.
About $35
million. $35 million. Yeah, what's money? We just money. Okay. Instead of just doing it, we'll just have everybody in favor of this, raise your hand. Those opposed? Okay, that motion is passed.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I have another motion, deals with the success of Representative Nicholas' motion, the $35 million, whatever that number, and it be in Section 3 on page 7. It's just simply the payout. I don't think it affect the actual early soundness of this. Instead of the entire amount this fiscal year, I would just split that number in half and pay the first half on July 1st of 2014 and the second half on July 1st of 2015, the state share.
I'd second the motion.
Okay, everybody understands that. All in favor, raise your hands. Okay, that motion carries. Any other amendments?
Mr. Chairman.
President Burkhart.
Motion for one small change on page 2, line 15.
You're moving in page 2, line 15, okay.
Change the date where it reads of fiscal year 2024. Change that date to 2044. There will still be people in the system in 30 years. It gives the towns, county, cities time to adjust that. While they will in the end pay more money, the annual payments are less.
Yeah, but I don't think if you're trying to deal with the amortization table and you want to extend that, instead of 10 years, make it 30 years is what you're doing.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have a second? We have a second? Okay, failed for lack of a second. Any other motions? Any other motions? Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to move, and Dave, help me out. As I understand the way this bill is drafted, that out there at 10 years out, if in fact we need to go on for another 4 or 5 years, the states fulfill their obligations. The firemen A continue to fulfill their obligations because of the COLA they have, but anything left would be solely the responsibility of the cities and towns. Is that correct? That is correct. Okay. I don't know how you put that in words to make that change, but my change would be that if, in fact, when we get to the 10-year period, that for whatever reason, a bad market, that the sole responsibility is shared, that the state is involved in the same percentages with the cities, towns, and counties we just voted on, 80-20. It's just not fair to put it all on the cities and towns back 10 years from now if everything goes to heck, and they're expected to pick it up to try to get to this funding level of 100%.
Second motion.
Do you understand what I'm saying, Dave? Does everybody understand what I'm, the motion? Dave?
To do that, my question off the top of my head is whether you could bind the future legislature to say in 10 years from now you will make an additional appropriation as necessary to do that.
I withdraw my motion. Let's work on that, and we'll give that some thought. Okay. Okay, committee, any
Mr.
other
Chairman?
Amendments? Someone, Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mine's probably a conceptual amendment as well, but it's to take the money, rather than it coming out of the general fund, that the state intercept severance taxes before they tip into the permanent mineral trust fund.
Okay, is there a second? This is the 1% statutory diversion of about $140 million every year. Is there a second? Okay, we have a motion to second. I would speak against that. I think that you know, one of the things that put the state in the kind of position we're in to be able to even fund government the levels we do is the strength of our permanent mineral trust fund and the revenue generated by that. And if we hadn't built that years ago, I don't know where we'd be in the tough times. And I think that given the nature of the funding levels we have and the funds available, I would think we need to continue to build for the future. And I think that's a big responsibility we have, and we've made some real progress last session. I don't think we should stop that. In fact, Mr. Chokechair, you said $8 billion by 18 or something, so I would speak against that motion. Okay, we're gonna have any further discussion? Okay, all in favor, raise your hands.
Mr.
Opposed, raise your hands.
On what? Oh, on the.
Well, let's start over again. We have a motion to. Are you clear? You want to do it again? Okay, we'll do it again. All in favor of the motion to tap the statutory 1% diversion and utilize those funds for this, raise your hands. Okay, opposed, raise your hands. Okay, that motion fails.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah. Dave, I got a question for you. As far as the money that's being deposited into the state auditor's account, you know, the study showed that we're going to pay that out of there over a 10-year basis. Is that how the bill's written right now? Or are we just going to dump it right into the account and we get to use that account in the retirement fund?
Mr. Chairman, the way the bill's written is it all's dumped into the retirement account from the state the very first year. Now it'll be half of that the first year, then whatever's necessary the second year based on Representative Harshman's motion from the state side.
Okay.
Senator Meyer?
The other, then that's going to, I guess, impact the amount of money that's actually going to have to be paid by the cities and towns in subsequent years. It's going to reduce it substantially. Okay. All right. I've got it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other amendments, proposed amendments to 0071.W5?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any proposed amendments, but I would like to get the printout as soon as we can from the Department of Retirement on what the payout will be for the cities, and so we've got something to work over the holidays.
Yeah, what I'd like to do, committee, Mr. Co-Chair, if it's all right with you, we'll see if the bill passes or fails. If it passes, then there, I want to go over before you all leave some of the things we want to have as this bill moves forward.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Meyer.
And while the department's here, do you have anything in your budget for legislative-directed studies?
You don't have to answer that. Senator Perkins.
All right, right. And also, because we've split it, it's not going to, you know, now that we don't have, now your studies are all out the window, the fact that that'll also affect your actuarial table because we're depositing it not all this year but next year, that'll affect the amount as well. Okay.
Yeah, there's some things we're going to have to get some information on. Okay. Any other amendments?
Mr. Chairman. Before we vote, I'd just like to tell all the folks, and I know you've said this too, thank everybody for coming, but I would just remind folks that, and I kind of said this in November in Casper, we're about on the second step of a 100-step process. And so your input from the cities, towns, and certainly the firemen, who have served our communities, now the time for input is wide open, if in fact this bill passes this committee. So don't leave here today. If there's something else you want, change this bill. Keep working it. The process is far from over, very far. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
And Mr. Chairman, if I've got...
Representative Nicholas.
I was just trying to run the numbers roughly, and the difference, as I've calculated, between 2013... in 2025, a compound interest versus simple interest is $61,100 versus $62,900. So over the course of 12 years, we're fighting over $1,200 at the end of that point. So I realize that it's all hard-fought money, and the COLA has an emotional component to it. But it's I think if we look at the hard numbers, it's and compared to what the state's coughing up, $35 million, it's a pretty nice compromise.
Mr. Co-Chair? Representative Nicholas, I think you bring up a good point. And I think if we could get those numbers, you can get those nailed down for us. That'd be part of the info we're going to need. Thank you.
Anybody else on the committee have anything else to say? Don, you raised your hand. Or Dave, one of you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, you do have a choice in the bill that has not been resolved yet. On page 4, it allows, in the event that the fund is doing well, it allows the COLA or the increase to be 5%, and then the alternative language holds it at 2.1% on page 5. But you should elect one or the other.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move to insert the language that holds it at the 2.1%.
Second. Discussion? All in favor, raise your hands. Okay, that motion carries. Anything else? You got to be quick on. I counted. Any other discussion on the bill? Any other discussion? I want to thank everybody, too, for doing this. I've been doing this for a while, and this is one of the, I think, the toughest bills that we've had to deal with because of things that happened years ago that a lot of us had nothing to do with. And yet we recognize the exposure and the obligation to the state, and we talked about the moral fiber of what we do, and I think we're making progress, Pat. And you well know this is the first step in a lot of steps to go, and I look forward to the continuing discussion. And well, we haven't decided whether this will be a House bill or a Senate file, and it'll be a House bill. Any other discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope it'll survive introduction.
Okay. We're ready for the vote. All take the roll.
Senator Ducksetter. Senator Hastert. Senator Meyer. Senator Perkins.
Aye.
Representative Burkhart.
No.
Representative Esquivel.
No.
Representative Moniz.
No.
Representative Nicholas.
Aye.
Representative Stupson.
Aye.
Representative Wallace.
Aye.
Pro-Chairman Harshman.
Aye.
Chairman Bebout.
No. There. And it passes, correct?
I could, Mr. Chairman, it passes.
Passes 3-2 in the Senate, and what was the number in the House? I want to be sure we're right on this.
4-2 and one conflict in the House.
So it did pass. Okay. Thank you, committee. Thank you, everybody, for attending. We're going to take about a 5-minute JAC stretch. Okay, Pat, we're just not quite at a quorum. Just hang tight a second here. I like your tie, by the way.
And now yours, Mr. Chairman.
You know,
you had the memo,
huh? We talk every morning. Yeah, why don't you do that, please?
Okay. Probably back there eating that chocolate cake in the break room.
To vote yes. Right now, I gotta.